Call 1-800-653-9400.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Nanette Savard, Terrence Aselford, and Colleen Delaney.
Episode 3, A Meeting of Minds. The Court of Lionstone 14 was a single vast chamber somewhere within the Imperial Palace, set within a massive steel bunker deep below the surface of Golgotha. No one knew precisely how big the chamber was for security reasons, but so far it had always proven big enough to hold whatever worlds or conditions Lionstone chose to recreate. The court was an Arctic waste this time, as real as holographic projections, strategically placed props and temperature controls could make it. Unfortunately, it also reflected her sense of humor, which could be pretty basic on occasion. Courtiers knew better than to sit down on anything, no matter how apparently comfortable, and approached the luxurious food and wine provided as a form of Russian roulette. Sitting comfortably on her iron throne, Lionstone 14 looked interestedly from one face to the other as army and church argued before her. General Beckett, slow and unperturbed, taking the time to enjoy his cigar between answers, and Cardinal Kasser, his single eye glowing with the unquenchable fire of the true fanatic. Lionstone liked to watch them argue, not least because while they were arguing with each other, they weren't teaming up to dispute with her. Divide and conquer worked just as well in court politics as it did in wars. It helped that Kasser and Beckett hated each other's guts. Neither was strong enough individually to threaten her authority, but together they would have made a formidable enemy. So Lionstone found it expedient to keep their ire concentrated on each other. It didn't take much. A kind word here, a knowing look there, and they snapped at the bait like hungry sharks. Which was why they stood before her now, bristling at each other like junkyard dogs, blind to everything but the need to score points off each other. Lionstone smiled to herself. Men were so predictable.
As any fool could see, the alien attack is a direct threat against humanity,
said Cardinal Kasser, his voice colder than the air around him.
We can't just sit here and wait for them to attack again. We must hunt them down and wipe them out. Any other way risks the suicide of our species.
A really good way to commit suicide is to launch yourself blindly into a situation you know nothing about, said General Beckett calmly. You saw what one ship on its own was able to do to us. Silence and the Dauntless were able to handle it, but that was one of our finest ships, with one of our finest crews, against what could, after all, have been nothing more than a simple probe. We need more information before committing ourselves to definite plans.
It's a matter of faith. I wouldn't expect you to understand that, Beckett.
It's a matter of common sense, Cardinal. I wouldn't expect you to understand that.
Sounds like cowardice to me. Staying safe at home here while your men take all the risks out on the rim. Well, here isn't safe anymore, Beckett. Either we go to them or they'll come to us.
Beckett took the cigar out of his mouth and looked at it thoughtfully.
What happened was a goddamn bee sting or a sunburn.
Competence. If the attack is going to come from anywhere, it'll come from the rim. Hence the extra patrols I ordered. They're going to be our early warning system. In my experience, fighting wars is a matter of practicality, not heroics. But then, you've always been a dreamer, Kasser, with little grasp of the practicalities of life. Comes with a job, I suppose.
Kasser glared at him, and then turned his burning gaze on Lionstone.
Put me in charge of your armies, and I'll provide you with an unbeatable force of the faithful, trained in all the martial arts, ready to dare anything in the name of the Church.
I've always fought in the name of the Empress, myself.
General Beckett blew a triumphant puff of smoke in Kasser's direction. The Cardinal hesitated, suddenly aware of the dangerous waters his rhetoric had swept him into. Beckett continued, taking advantage of the pause.
Fanatics can be very useful when it comes to building a power base, but in my experience, they make bloody poor soldiers. Fanatics are fine at getting themselves killed in the name of their cause. I prefer to put my faith in trained professional soldiers who will put their energies into staying alive long enough to kill the enemy.
Kasser started to splutter, so eager to get back at Beckett that his words were tumbling over themselves. Lionstone sat back on her throne, openly enjoying his discomposure. Beckett puffed happily on his cigar. And that was when Mother Beatrice emerged from the crowd to join the debate and throw oil on troubled fires. Beatrice Christiana had been due to marry Valentine Wolfe on Jacob's instructions, but it hadn't happened. Beatrice was a forceful, assured, and occasionally violent woman who knew her own mind and had no intention whatsoever of marrying a notorious drug fiend, degenerate, and general weirdo. She threatened everything up to and including murder to get out of the match, but no one took her seriously. Until the day of the wedding, when she punched out Valentine, kicked the presiding vicar in the nuts, and made a run for sanctuary with the Sisters of Mercy. The one place no one would follow her. Their nunneries were inviolate by long tradition. The Sisters of Mercy were the only impartial force in the Empire, tied to no one side or cause or class, but offering their help to all impartially. They were much loved and trusted by one and all, which made them very useful when it came to sorting out family disputes and brokering truces, among other things. Beatrice had risen rapidly through the ranks and was now a mother superior, complete with voluminous black robe and starched wimple. It helped that, as well as being particularly spiritual, she was also incredibly wealthy. She took her place in court, defying anyone to say anything, and was rapidly emerging as a sane countervoice to both the military and the established church. Valentine took it all easily enough, understanding that it had all been entirely personal on Beatrice's part. He sent her a note saying he thought her new outfit was very sexy, and enclosed the bill for the wedding. Since then, Beatrice had put a great deal of energy into magnificently ignoring him. Now she stood before the Iron Throne, eyes sparkling merrily. She bowed to the Empress and looked challengingly at the General and the Cardinal. Beckett smiled and gave her the nod one gives a respected adversary. Kasser glared at her. He saw her as a dangerous heretic and made no bones about saying so loudly in public, until both the Sisters of Mercy and his own superiors in the church told him to shut the hell up. This infuriated Kasser even more, luckily to the point of incoherence. Not that Beatrice cared a whit. As long as the sisters remained separate from the established church, Kasser had no power over her, and they both knew it. She smiled at Lionstone, who acknowledged her with a nod.
If I might interrupt, Your Majesty, it seems to me that both church and army are too rooted in their positions to see the truth. If the alien ship is representative of the aliens' power, we could be in real trouble when their fleet turns up. We have a whole empire to protect, while the aliens are free to concentrate their forces at any point they choose. One ship turned our main starport and city into rubble. Imagine what a fleet of them could do to a planet, with or without its defenses. We have to face the fact that for the first time, we find ourselves facing an opponent who may well be stronger than us. Not forgetting, of course, that we already have hard evidence that there may be more than one powerful alien species out there. Your Majesty has been saying this for some time, but I think we're all now more ready to believe it. Our only chance for survival as a species Maybe to bring all our assets to bear against the enemy, or enemies. That could include even those who would normally oppose us. I'm talking about the rebels and the clone and Espa undergrounds.
Are you mad, woman? Make deals with those scum? They're not even human.
They think they are, and I think they'd fight to defend humanity against an alien threat if we asked them nicely. It's in their interest. If the Empire is destroyed, they'd be wiped out along with the rest of us. They have talents and powers and abilities that we're going to need. Does anyone here doubt they'd make excellent attack troops? Just the fact that they're still around despite everything we've done to exterminate them shows they're survivors, if nothing else.
May I just point out that it was the rebels' lowering of Golgotha's defenses that made the aliens' attack possible?
They were probably working with the aliens.
All the more reason to contact them and get them on our side.
They are guilty of crimes against humanity. The guilty must be punished.
On the other hand...
Beckett rolled his cigar sensuously between his fingers to hear the leaves crackle.
If we don't bring the rebels into the fold, they might just take the opportunity to stab us in the back while we're distracted by the alien attack.
Kill them all! Clones and espers and non-people. They're as alien to us as anything that might come from beyond the rim.
Typical of the Church these days. Rather fight than think. Rather lose than try diplomacy. Fanatics unite. You have nothing to lose but your mind.
Well said. I couldn't have put it better myself.
They all looked around to find Valentine Wolfe had emerged from the crowd and was standing right behind them. Beatrice ostentatiously moved a step away to put more distance between herself and the wolf. Valentine smiled at her dazzlingly. Cassar glared at him.
What do you want, degenerate?
Well, I have a list if you're interested, Cassar, but you're really not my type. I just wanted to agree with everything Beatrice said.
Thanks a whole bunch. If you're on my side, they'll never believe me. You do this to me deliberately, don't you? Just because I wouldn't marry you, you're determined to ruin my life.
You wound me deeply. Can't a man speak out for common sense and sanity anymore?
And what the hell would you know about sanity? There are depressed lemmings on the edges of cliffs who've got a better grasp on reality than you have, and more common sense.
If you two would like a little privacy...
Beckett decided not to say any more as Beatrice glared at him.
I would rather be left in the company of a piranha with an overbite. Don't you move one step, General. That goes for you too, Cassar. Loathsome though your presence undoubtedly is, it is still preferable to that of the genetic disaster area currently heading the Wolf family. I understand there are plans for the Dangerous Chemicals Investigation Board to have him declared a toxic waste dump. Maybe then we could have him banned from inhabited areas on health grounds.
The Empress spoke from her throne.
Young love.
Not all that far away, Gregor Schreck glared at the company before the Iron Throne. By rights, he should have been there too, adding his words and wisdom to whatever they were discussing. He was head of one of the oldest families in the Empire, and a man to be noticed. But he had been robbed of his true position in society by backstabbing traitors who refused to admit his true qualities. They smiled at his face, laughed at his back, and whispered against him. They'd pay. They would all pay one day. But that could wait. For the moment, he had little room in himself for anything but rage. Evangeline had left him. The ungrateful little bitch had actually dared to walk out on him. Together with that cow, Adrienne, she'd found the courage to outface him. But they'd find out soon enough that no one downed Gregor Schreck and lived to boast of it. Evangeline might think herself safe among the underground and the non-people, but there was bound to be a weak link somewhere, and he had all the time, money, and venom he needed to find it. Someone would respond to money or pressure or the right kind of deal. Someone always did. and then he'd get her. It wouldn't be long before people started noticing that Evangeline wasn't around. People in Tower Shrek would talk. You couldn't stop them. Then people in the court would spot a potential weakness and start asking questions. Where was she? What had happened to her? What had he done to her? There were always people ready to stick their noses in where they didn't belong. He could always clone another Evangeline. He still had the tissue samples from the original. But it would take months to rear and train her. It had with the last one. And what if the first clone reappeared? There'd be no way to hide what he'd done with two Evangelines walking around. And there was always the possibility the first clone might tell all anyway, from a safe distance, as a kind of revenge. She'd find it hard to prove anything without revealing herself, but just the accusation would be damaging. Mud sticks, particularly when people want it to. Gregor scowled. These days, more than ever, it was vital that he seem above reproach. In recent months, he'd taken steps to publicly become very religious and did everything he could to win the established church's approval. He needed their support if he was to win himself a place up in the rarefied heights where he deserved to be. However, in order to win the church's backing, he'd had to set up a public reputation as being purer than pure. This had taken some doing. In the past, he'd gone his own way, did what he wanted when he wanted, and let his people clean up the mess afterward with money or threats. Typical enough behavior for an aristocrat with money to burn and more hormones than sense. Luckily, the church didn't care much about your past, as long as you repented publicly, made a large donation, and put it all behind you. Gregor didn't care tuppence for the first two, but balked at the third. There were limits. Still, there was public, and then there was private. As long as he looked good in the public eye, rumored sins could be forgiven, even ignored. Gregor had never been any good at public relations, but fortunately there were members of his family who were. They were currently standing just behind him, waiting for his instructions, if they knew what was good for them. Gregor turned to face them, giving them both his best forbidding stare. Toby the Troubadour was his nephew, loath though he sometimes was to admit it. A short, fat, perspiring fellow with flat blonde hair, a ready smile, a mind like a steel trap, and the morals of a starving sewer rat. His main duties and responsibilities were to write up the family's doings in the best possible light, and then see to it that those reports appeared in all the right places. Journals, hollow shows, gossip columns. He was a public relations man, spin doctor, damage limitations expert, and a first-class liar. He had to be. It wasn't easy making Gregor Shrek look good. The rest of the clan had their moments, bless their black little hearts, but Toby knew how to handle them. If they didn't toe the line when he needed them to, with a prepared speech here and an appearance there, smiling and waving for the cameras, he just left them out of his reports entirely until they did. After all, the only thing worse than being talked about by everyone is not being talked about by everyone. If your face wasn't in all the glossies and the hollow shows, you weren't anyone. Toby could make you a celebrity, famous for being famous, if you followed the rules. His rules. Namely, do what you like as long as it's entertaining, but only as long as I get to hear about it first so I can make sure it's got the right spin on it before it hits the streets. Unfortunately, he couldn't order Gregor about like that. If he'd ever been dumb enough to try, Gregor would have ripped out his vocal cords as a warning.
"Talk to me, boy," said Gregor sharply. "What are you saying about Evangeline at present?"
"The official line is she's resting after overdoing it,"
Toby said smoothly.
"We haven't specified exactly what she's been overdoing, but the gossips will come up with something. They do so love to speculate. Presumably you'll let me know when she's rested enough so I can reintroduce her to society?"
"I'll tell you what you need to know, when you need to know it. How's my current standing with the church?"
"Reasonable," Though I do wish you'd learn to watch your language, Uncle. Sometimes I think the church would happily pardon adultery, but not the specific four-letter word used to describe it. Most people will turn a specifically deaf ear if I pay them enough, whether it concerns obscenities or political malaprops. But sooner or later, you're going to say the wrong thing in front of the wrong people, and there won't be a thing I can do to help you.
It was your idea for us to get into bed with the church in the first place. Can't say I've seen much in the way of results.
With the church behind us, we are safe from a great many other enemies. But if the church ever finds out about the real you, we could be in real trouble.
Then you'd better make damn sure they don't, hadn't you?
I do wish you two wouldn't fight,
said Grace Shrek, knowing they wouldn't listen to her. They never did. She was Gregor's older sister and did her best to look as little like him as possible. She was long, tall, and thin, with a pale, swan-like neck, and a mass of white hair piled up on top of her head in a rather precarious-looking style that hadn't been fashionable in years. She wore the same style of clothes she had when she was young, and noticed newer styles only in order to criticize them. Every now and again, fashion rediscovered her look, and for a month or so she would be the height of fashion, which embarrassed her greatly. Grace preferred not to be noticed, whenever possible. She'd never married, because after their parents had died suddenly, Gregor had needed her services as assistant, secretary, and general dog's body while he was holding the family together and making it great again. There'd been no time for romance, no chance for a life of her own. The family needed her, Gregor needed her, and she'd had to settle for that. And if she was ever angry, she kept it to herself. Eventually, there came a time when Gregor didn't need her anymore, but she stayed with him anyway, because she didn't know any other kind of life. The world had changed during her enforced absence, and people frightened her, whether they meant to or not. Besides, she'd always known Gregor would never let her go. He couldn't risk her marrying and moving outside the family's influence, outside of his control. She knew too much about the clan in general, and him in particular, and the things he'd done to make the Shreks great again. She came to court as little as possible, because crowds upset her, but the Empress's edict had been quite specific for once. Everyone in the families was to come. No exemptions. If you were on your deathbed, bring your deathbed with you. So Grace came on Gregor's arm, stayed close to Toby, and tried to pretend she was just watching it on the hollow. She disapproved of the way Gregor treated Toby, but didn't know what to do about it. Certainly, Gregor wouldn't listen to her, even if she could bring herself to say anything. Toby's father had been Christian Shrek, younger brother to herself and Gregor. He disappeared years ago, after a furious head-to-head with Gregor, and was never seen again. The Empress ordered an investigation, but nothing ever came of it. Gregor submitted to questioning by an Imperial Esper, and surprised everyone by passing the test with ease. He was officially cleared. But after that, people stopped resisting Gregor's rise to power. Toby came under Gregor's influence the same way every Shrek did, because he had no choice. Toby had a sister once, but the Empress took her to be one of her maids, and that was that. Grace couldn't protect or advance him, so that just left Gregor. And so now the Shrek used Toby as he'd once used Grace, and there was nothing she could do about it. Another life sacrificed to Gregor's ambition. That was just the way things were in Clan Shrek. Grace sighed tiredly. She missed Christian. He'd been the only one in the family with a sense of humor. She realized Gregor was shouting at Toby again. Gregor was having a hard time being a public person. He wasn't suited to it. Grace looked at Gregor, red-faced and sweating as he raised his voice yet again, and suddenly it seemed to her that this was just the most recent in a long series of straws that broke the camel's back. She stepped forward and slapped Gregor smartly on the arm with her folded fan.
Gregor, I won't have you using that kind of language in public. Remember, we are at court. People are listening.
And you can shut your stupid mouth as well. When I want your opinion, I'll have my head examined.
Really?
Grace could feel herself blushing, as she always did when someone spoke harshly to her.
Why can't we all just be friends? In public, at least.
She's right, you know. The church believes in happy families.
Stuff the church! I have a right to be angry. I can't believe Valentine turned me down. It's so obviously in both our interests to work together against our enemies that even he should have been able to see the advantages. All right, he's a drug-soaked weirdo with no more common sense than a leper playing volleyball. But if we'd stood together, no one would have dared stand against us.
Can't say I'm sorry. Valentine may be number one at the moment, but there's no one here who likes or trusts him, despite all the smiles in his direction. Putting a good PR shine on an alliance between you two would have really strained my creativity. You'd have a better chance of selling lepers' fingers as a fashion accessory. So what now, Uncle? Move to Plan B?
What's Plan B? No one's ever mentioned any Plan B to me. Honestly, Gregor, you never tell me anything anymore.
That's because you don't need to know anything. Just shut up and do as you're told. Stay here with Toby. Don't move. I'll take care of Plan B.
Gregor stalked away without looking back. He knew they wouldn't move without his permission. Plan B was the Chojiros. If the first family wouldn't deal, there was always the chance the second might. He kicked his way through the deep snow, and people moved quickly to get out of his way. But he no more noticed that than the air that he breathed. He drew himself up before Bibi Chojiro, glared briefly at the investigator beside her to show he wasn't intimidated, and then bowed briefly to Bibi. She bowed back, calm and assured. Razor ignored him.
We have a common enemy in the wolves. May I suggest that it is in our interest to combine against Valentine? You produce the computers for his starships, and I make the shells. But as long as he controls production of the new star drive, we have to run our businesses to suit him. With just the right pressure and timing, he could ruin either one of us, even drive us out of business completely, so he could move in and take over. I had planned to work with the Campbells back when they looked to be in the lead for the Star Drive contract. We had an understanding. That's why I permitted a linking marriage. But that fell through, and Valentine won't deal. I work under his conditions, or I don't work at all. And that is completely unacceptable. So I need an ally to make sure I don't get squeezed out, and you need someone to watch your back while you work with him. We could both profit from such a union. And after all, neither of us has any cause to love Valentine.
Both?
Said Bibi.
I think not. All the profit would be on your side. We don't need you, Lord Shrek. And you have nothing we want. Yes, you build shells, but anyone can build shells. And to be honest, Lord Shrek, we're rather choosy about who we ally ourselves with.